You're listening to the Noncompliant Podcast. I'm your host, Anne Borden King. In this episode and the previous one, we've departed a bit from the neurodiversity-focused topics to talk about the monkeypox health crisis, public health, and health disinformation. We know that a lot of health disinformation circles back to autism disinformation because that was the original modern anti-vax lie, that vaccines cause autism, and that movement created so much of the playbook for the health disinformation we see today around COVID, monkeypox, and other diseases, especially on social media, which we'll be talking about today. My guest is Benjamin Ryan. Benjamin Ryan is an independent science reporter who's been covering infectious disease and LGBTQ health for two decades. He's been covering the monkeypox outbreak for NBC News and has published op-eds on the topic in the Washington Post. He also contributes to the New York Times, The Guardian, and Thomson Reuters Foundation. You can check him out on Twitter at Ben Ryan Writer, or at his website, benryan.net. I'm happy to welcome Ben to the show. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with the basics. Ben, what is monkeypox? How is it spread? And who is most affected by the outbreak in the U.S. and Canada?
So monkeypox belongs to the family of orthopox viruses that also includes smallpox, which was eradicated about three quarters of the way through the 20th century. And it is become endemic in 11 African nations in West and Central Africa since it was first discovered in humans in 1970 and was discovered in animals in 1958. So typically it transmits at rather a slow burn in Africa. There's a lot more zoonotic transmission than it is necessarily a community transmission. But this May, it started spreading quite rapidly around the world, starting in Western Europe, and overwhelmingly spreading during sex between men. And so currently there are over 40,000 cases globally, and about a third of those are in the United States. And it really is quite remarkable how throughout the past 4 months or so of this outbreak, that the demographics have remained very consistent, that there have been very few cases in women and children. The cases are overwhelmingly in men, and particularly in men who have sex with men. So that's something that a lot of the disinformation folks out there don't want to hear, and they would like to push a different agenda or a different narrative about this. But I think, frankly, I'm surprised more people aren't fascinated by the consistency mm-hmm. of the demographics and more interested in knowing why, as opposed to sort of pushing like, oh, well, this is going to happen explosively in children any day now.
What's motivating the disinformation campaigns about monkeypox?
I wish I knew, but I can say in one particular case, what's really happened, you know, just as a journalist who's been on Twitter a lot about this, and you have to always keep reminding yourself, Twitter is not the real world. It does have real world implications sometimes, but if you polled the average person, you would not have the same results if you polled Twitter versus the real world. But there are some really big names of people with doctorates, PhDs, MDs from the COVID world, and they gained huge followings. And a lot of their followers respond very well to hysteria and mm-hmm. fear. So there's a big motivation to promote fear and hysteria about anything, frankly. And you can see these same names moving into the monkeypox space and trying to colonize it and essentially establish a narrative that they control. And there's one person in particular that, frankly, I don't want to name because, you know, you never know if people are going to be litigious, frankly. But this person in particular was really pushing the notion that healthcare workers were at high risk of contracting monkeypox on the job. And there's no evidence of this. You look to the World Health Organization's data, there are constantly updated reports. They say, you know, currently there have been about 400 healthcare workers out of the, you know, 40,000 some odd cases around the world who have contracted monkeypox. But they're clear, they make sure to say that these people have, as far as they know, contracted the virus in the community, and they haven't found any evidence of it happening in the workplace. And what happens is you hear people saying this, that, oh, there's this big risk of healthcare workers, therefore they deserve to cut in line for the vaccines. And that's when you can have a real world implication of this kind of disinformation, when you're fighting over resources. And if you get, say, some politician that falls for this and they start pressuring it, you never know where that actually could have implications for real policy. And luckily, the CDC, at least here in the United States, does prioritize the highest risk groups, men of sex men, you know, especially those who have engaged in sex with multiple partners recently, to receive this vaccination, because all the data show from here in the United States and around the world that those are the people at most risk.
It's such compelling data, too. I mean, it's such a high number. Yeah. It's 95-99% when I see the data. So I think it would be hard to persuade, I hope it would be hard to persuade public health agencies to allow people to cut the line, especially because isn't there a bit of a limit in terms of how much vaccine they've been able to make at this point?
It's very complicated and it's hard to really understand the complexities of the situation, but indeed, there's a long production line when it comes to the vaccine, which is made by a single manufacturer in Copenhagen, in Denmark. And the U.S. essentially has dibs on millions of doses, but they're all in various stages of production, and it takes time for them to get out of there. So the U.S. thus far has distributed about 1 million doses, and they have essentially about 360,000 that are also now ready to go. But what they've done is they've shifted the injection method to a new method that allows you, in theory, to use 1/5 of the dose, which in theory has the same immunological effect, which hopefully will then prevent the virus at the same effect. All of this is based on, you know, research that has not been done in a randomized controlled trial the way you would like, mind you. So it's a, kind of going out on a limb, So yes, they're having great limitations in the availability of vaccines, which the government, U.S. government is trying to solve. But yes, we do have scarce resources. Therefore, if you have a health emergency and your resources are dear, you need to prioritize to try to make the best use of what you have. So if there are disinformation campaigns that would ever affect the policy, then that could be very troubling and would essentially cause you to waste those resources.
Also with monkeypox, I've heard that it's possible that the smallpox vaccine that people got back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s may work for people who had it back then in terms of offering a level of protection, because this type of virus doesn't mutate in the absolutely like off-the-wall way that the coronavirus mutated. And I think that's something that gets lost. And I talked about it in the last episode with Dr. Alex Greninger, who's a virologist, who said that you can't just take the lens of COVID-19 and apply it to monkeypox, because the viruses don't behave the same way.
Also, for one thing, COVID transmitted to everybody. So it's given, you know, logarithmically more opportunities to mutate because of that than this here virus, monkeypox, which transmits much less readily. It seems to require a very high level of intimacy, namely sexual intercourse, to transmit. There are exceptions, but predominantly that seems to be the way it's transmitting around the world at this point.
Right.
And you know, just to your point about the smallpox vaccine, we have seen cases in the case reports of people contracting monkeypox who have at some time in their life had the smallpox vaccine. So when you ask WHO officials about it, they're essentially, they kind of say, like, we're not sure, don't hang your hat on this. But at the same time, they do also think that one of the reasons why we're seeing this outbreak now is that in general around the world, smallpox vaccination plans, campaigns, they stopped around between 1970 and 1980. So you have these cohorts of people who are now growing up and, you know, getting into middle age and so on, who don't have the vaccination. So it's possible that part of it is that there is more of a population out there now who aren't protected by that, at least what's left of the vaccine after many decades for the older cohort.
I want to talk a little bit about the grassroots, because as you've pointed out in some of your writing, decades of activism and advocacy in response to the HIV/AIDS crisis created some of the building blocks for a pandemic response when COVID hit, and now advocates are at it again to working to make sure that public health does its best in response to monkeypox. How has the grassroots been active in this?
Well, I was just speaking with Greg Millett, and he is at AMFAR and used to be with the CDC. He's a big expert on HIV there. And he was talking about how a lot of the younger cohorts, the people who weren't directly involved in the HIV crisis years, which you would consider to be 1981 to 1996, when effective treatments were finally released, those younger people have really studied those years and, you know, heard about them so much and read all the books about them, and thus have been primed to respond, you know, as their sort of elders did. And that's indeed what's happening. I can certainly say that in my own life. I'm 44. So I came out of the closet as a 17-year-old in 1996. In fact, almost the very month that antiretrovirals came on the market to end the crisis years of HIV, you know, and indeed I've been studying this. So, you know, both were working with older cohorts who are repeating the same kind of activism styles, but we're also, you know, we have learned from them over time. So, you know, a lot of the HIV activists, you know, as you said, like PrEP for All, for example, is a very influential activist group that has fought for HIV prevention drug access. And then they, you know, they fought for the COVID vaccine access. And now they're the ones who really dug deep to find all the truth about the Jynneos vaccine from Denmark, the monkeypox vaccine, you know, that's in short supply. And they're the ones who really sort of fed into journalists, you know, all of the intel of what's been happening. Hmm. So in the same token, all the same public health people, Dimitri Daskalakis, who's the deputy in the White House now for the monkeypox response, he was the head of HIV prevention in New York City, and then had the same job at the CDC, and now is in the White House. So you see all the same players and the same experts, which is great for me because I can reach out to all the same people I know for contacts. But we're the people who sort of know all the patterns and recognize also what can go wrong, you know, all the racial disparities for access and, you know, the racial inequities and that sort of thing. And, you know, just sort of looking out for that and trying to combat them in real time.
Right, right. It seems like all the troubleshooting around it, around every aspect of it, that's really, the grassroots is really a key element for helping and ensuring that public health is on top of it. Is that right?
Absolutely. I mean, you'll read all the reporting. New York Times, Washington Post have done such a great job of getting to the bottom of what exactly has gone wrong. How has the federal government fumbled in this regard? And, you know, there are many people at the CDC and elsewhere at NIH who absolutely, I do not doubt for a second, you know, how committed they are to fighting this. And yet they still have made decisions that weren't the greatest. But you look back to the early weeks of this outbreak, you know, you read what the Washington Post has reported, and then you see people who, some other people, you know, frankly needed some convincing to be a little bit more urgent. And that's really where activism comes in. And, you know, when activists are working with journalists to kind of expose people, you know, or other ways that activists may communicate in their own regard, that really puts the fire beneath a government to get them to, for example, get the FDA to move up its inspection of the production facility in Denmark where all of these vaccines are made. It was supposed to be done in October or something. It was moved up to July. I have a pet theory, do not quote me on this, everybody, that people's vacations had to be interrupted or something. And that was one of the reasons why, you know, it took a while to do this. But that's the kind of change, you know, in action on the part of government or governmental regulators that speed up access, that is indeed a direct result of the kind of pressure and, if you will, the kind of shaming that activists do.
That's great. I mean, it's such an important component to it. It gets forgotten. I think that also in terms of around the communication, grassroots has had some role in improving the communication. I wanted to talk about sex phobia and homophobia in some of the earlier communication from public health about monkeypox. What's the status of that right now?
It's continually evolving, I would say. I was just looking on Twitter, you know, a doctor was using a phrase that drives me crazy, which is, quote unquote, anyone can get monkeypox. That drives me nuts because it seems very well-meaning. And I think a lot of public health officers or journalists who parrot them say it because they're trying to diffuse the kind of stigma that comes when you make clear to the public that a disease such as HIV or monkeypox is overwhelmingly occurring amongst gay and bisexual men who are stigmatized minorities. So there's a lot of good intent there. When they're trying to keep the rest of the population, the non-gay population, you know, ready to keep them in mind, they might contract this virus. But the thing is, this is a very symptomatic virus. So in the odds that somebody gets it, you know, and they have all these lesions, they're probably going to go to the doctor. And hopefully that doctor knows what monkeypox is by now. It's been many months that we're into this outbreak, and they would do something about it. So I don't really buy the argument that you have to try extra hard to get the general public to be aware of this, because there are steps that will inevitably push them to the doctor, you know, and then hopefully the doctor knows what they're doing. So that drives me crazy, because what it does when people say anyone can get monkeypox is it really downplays how overwhelmingly this is occurring amongst gay men. And I really wish that people would be more direct in their communication, saying this is overwhelmingly occurring in this population. And we believe that it's transmitted, you know, via intercourse. That's what the studies show. We're not totally sure yet, you know, the skin to skin contact that comes with it may be a lesser part. You know, more research is needed. But given what we know now, here are some thoughts on how you might protect yourself. And the CDC does have, you know, safer sex guidelines. But the CDC, in my viewing, has been overly vague. They don't include the words man, men, or gay in their safer sex guidelines. You know, they sort of claim this is sort of a way to make them more palatable to the public and not alienate people. And I don't think it's a matter of using more inclusive language for trans people, by the way. It really is just sort of like trying to sort of soften the blow, if you will. And I've told them, you know, and I've written op-eds about this and told them to their faces that I really disagree with this because, you know, public health people say again and again, like, you have to meet people where you are. They always say that. And you have to communicate in language to them that makes clear to them that we're talking to you. So right. If you're talking to gay and bisexual men, you have to make that abundantly clear. So I think it's a long work in progress, but at least the CDC that I've heard has not said anyone can get monkeypox recently.
The one that I saw that was sort of early on, and I can't remember what public health agency it was, said something like, be careful about hugging, right? Like, and I felt like that was all they said. And so I felt like it was this gigantic euphemism. And it was really surprising to me that after all this time and all these years, it's still being euphemized like that.
Well, earlier you referred to like, let's not just take the COVID playbook and then scratch out the word COVID and put monkeypox in there. And I think a lot of people in their communications have been trying to do that. They're trying to push masks for this because that's something that they really want. And this is a virus that is just not transmitting in an airborne fashion that we can see. And I think what really bothers me is that in the communications people, both public health leaders and doctors, as well as journalists, they fail to stratify the risk. And, you know, if you were going to, you know, use your hand, let's say, and say the risk for sexual contact is way up here at my eye level. And then down here by my ankles is everything else, essentially. You know, the study out of the New England Journal of Medicine with 538 early cases of the virus found that they believe that 95% of cases were as a result of sex between men. And then only 0.8% were non-sexual close contact and 0.6% were household contact. So all these things you hear about, oh, we found it on surfaces, just because it's on a surface doesn't mean it's going to transmit that way. And I put out a survey to try to get some information from gay guys about how this is affecting their lives and have gotten 100 responses in this Google survey for an article I'm writing for NBC. And I've really been struck by how many of them say I'm avoiding hugging, hugging hello, shaking hands, going to crowded places. And I think earlier when there was a lot more uncertainty about how this was transmitting in this global outbreak, that might have been more prudent. But more and more, we're getting more and more data, and then we're just not seeing cases, you know, maybe a few in there, what might have been result, you know, of things that are much more casual. But, you know, we can't reorganize our entire lives around a remote possibility, especially for a virus that doesn't kill you. It's very unpleasant. But we can't have everybody just stop having fun and doing all these wonderful things that we do to get together, especially after the COVID epidemic, out of the odd chance that one person might have a terrible experience. And that might sound a little cold, but you know, they always reference every time you get in a car, you're putting your life at risk. And we accept these risks in our society. We do accept that there is a remote risk the plane will crash. So, you know, I do think it's especially important after, you know, the past 2 years that we get out and be with one another, because there are great costs to mental health and other things of not doing things like this, of not going to the gay pride parade and that kind of thing.
Yeah, but I think that some people have become really used to this kind of life, and it's they adapted to that. And I think adapting to the change now that we have for COVID, now that we have vaccines, now that we have Paxlovid, and we have better testing, and there's you know, milder variants, a lot has changed. But I think it's difficult for some people to climb out of where they were, this sort of bunker mentality that we all had in the first wave. I see that in and of itself as a really big mental health crisis and people that need to be cared for. But what I see on social media is there actually are people exploiting that to try to build their brand. I think they've taken, like I was saying earlier, the COVID lens of 2020, and they're trying to put it onto monkeypox. And I guess my question is, like, how can we combat that kind of disinformation so that people don't develop like phobias of like riding on the subway or like brushing up against somebody on the bus because of monkeypox?
I mean, that's a $10,000 question. Mm-hmm. I mean, just to say in my own life, you're talking about the safety nets that we do have now. So I've been treated for cancer all this summer, and I have testicular cancer, just finished 10 rounds of chemo, and I got COVID in the middle of it because I went to the John Mulaney show at Madison Square Garden and immediately got COVID afterwards. And I took Paxlovid, and then, of course, I rebounded. I took Paxlovid again, but I was only really sick for one day, and then I was fine. So, you know, I'm living proof of what can happen when you are immunocompromised. Go out into the world and have some fun. And then you have a safety net and it worked out. Granted, I'm an N-of-1, it's not a great scientific study, but like I am an example of that. But to your point, so in a recent article I wrote for NBC News, they referred to this study that was recently published. So some researchers in South America, in the very beginning of when the outbreak, the monkeypox outbreak was starting to hit the headlines, they analyzed Twitter traffic on monkeypox. And they found that about half of it was misinformation or unverifiable information. And just 28% included serious factual information. And then, big surprise, the misleading tweets did better. They had more replies and retweets. I wish I had a magic wand and, you know, the magic answer for you of like, how do you combat this? I can tell you that, you know, during the height of my chemo unpleasantness, when I really wasn't feeling well, a lot of what only I could do all day was just responding to misinformation on Twitter. I was just sitting there with this little lightsaber going after all the Darth Vaders of the misinformation world. I'm doing my best out there. So you never know. But I wish there were an answer better than that, than like we all have to do our part. But I guess just speaking to each individual person, and you hear a lot, for example, oh, the mainstream media is not to be trusted and all that sort of thing. And there's such terrible reporting. And I would say to that, well, yes, there is a lot of terrible reporting. Some reporters are terrible. They don't care about accuracy and that kind of thing. This is true. But there's also a lot of great reporting. Therefore, it is your responsibility as a member of society to discern between the two. So, you know, I basically call upon people like, try to be a better consumer of information. Stop, think, where is this information coming from? Do they have a firsthand source? Is that source trustworthy? That sort of thing. Like, does this person have an ulterior motive? Is this person looking to promote hysteria, as you're saying, to promote their own online brand and ultimately to, you know, sell their books or whatever it is they may be peddling online? So, you know, it's, some of it is up to this, each individual person who's out there in this very dark wilderness of social media.
Right, right. I mean, I think it's hard because people across the board, there seems to be, and I think social media amplifies this, like you were saying, there's a distrust of authority. So what's really shocked me since the year has turned over into 2022 is how I always knew the anti-vaxxers were always talking about cover-ups, conspiracies, all this kind of thing. But now when you flip over their coin, there's people on the other end of it also saying that there's cover-ups and incompetency and among people who don't think the government is keeping us safe enough from monkeypox from COVID. And so they're really, at this point, two sides of the same coin, especially when they talk about vaccines not working. If people are getting all of their information from social media, or almost all of it, in these little tiny pods where they just cancel and block anyone who says anything that they don't agree with, then how do we break people out of these pods? And I always come back to the great success, unfortunately, of the anti-vax movement. They kind of built their success on stories and people telling their story.
Well, what you're saying has been shown by sociological research. So I spoke with Sander van der Linden, who's a researcher on misinformation in the UK recently. And he said exactly what you say, is that the human brain responds to stories. If I say to you, 95% of these cases of monkeypox are in gay and bisexual men, and then I tell you the story of one baby getting it, and right, this is maybe one baby out of 20 million babies in the country, let's just say. I think there are more, maybe there are 10 million babies in the country, let's say. Your brain is going to remember that story about that one baby. During the HIV crisis era, you're going to remember the story of Ryan White way more than you're going to remember like all of the gay guys who got it. So unfortunately, like that's how we're primed. So as you're saying, like telling the stories, I was just writing kind of a how-to guide for NBC to publish. They have this thing, NBCU, they call it, to train journalists and give them advice about things. And I was saying just what you're saying is like, tell the stories, keep telling those stories over and over again, because people just, they'll just forget the data, because that's how we were evolved to think. There was no data, you know, when we were all, you know, in little hunter-gatherer tribes. There were narratives, you know?
Right. And so you have to hit two categories of people right now, I think. I think you have to hit the low-risk people to let them understand that they're low-risk, especially with schools starting. And and are people going to start freaking out when their kids go to school and tell them not to sit on the toilet seat and all this? Right. Like, you really want to reach those people for mental health reasons and also because of resources, as we talked about before. And then the second group that you have to really be able to reach to and talk to are people who are in the high-risk category right now.
Right. And I just want to reemphasize what you just said, because I think there is great value in telling people they're at low risk of some terrible outcome.
Yeah.
And I don't think the public health apparatus out there respects that enough. I think they want to hold that card just in case they need to play it. And they also don't want to go back later and have someone say they were wrong. Mm-hmm. So there's two things affecting their reluctance to say, you know what, all you people who are not men who have sex with men, you're at low risk. Schools, low risk. I get DMs from moms who are freaking out, you know, and I'm not a doctor, so I can't necessarily predict the future in the way that I think a social scientist would be better positioned to do with confidence to a mom in that position. But I can point them to research saying, this is what we've seen thus far. And so, you know, that's what hopefully you can look to that as some sort of reassurance. But as far as like high risk people, essentially what we've seen is the sort of profile of people who tend to get monkeypox at this point are men who have multiple sex partners with men. This is a virus that essentially has a relatively short infection window. The time after you acquire it and until you develop symptoms, which would essentially take you off the market, where you're like, I have this condition, whether you know what it is or not, you'll probably be less likely to engage in sexual activity. So that period is, you know, maybe a week, 3 weeks top. We don't really know for sure. But people who have multiple sex partners in that window are the people who are more likely to contract this. So if that means if you have somebody who is a potential sex partner, you know, waiting out that time period, for example, a lot of the cases that we see are from people who go to what are called sex on site venues, could be a sex party, you know, or a bathhouse or something like that. So reducing partners, reducing group sex, you know, and there are a lot of people out there choosing not to have sex for a time, or if they're in a relationship and engaging in monogamy. And there at least is a theory that condoms may help. And even if they don't eliminate the risk of the virus, it's possible they may reduce some of the worst symptoms of it. In a recent study out of Spain, they found there was an association between receptive anal intercourse and the likelihood of having what's called proctitis, which is the inflammation of the rectal tissues. So when people get lesions in those tissues, and that can be extremely painful, that's essentially the core thing that has made this outbreak really awful for people some people who are experiencing it. Because it seems that the initial place where the virus transmitted from person to person, that tends to be where you get the initial outbreak. So you get a lot of guys who are getting them in the genital area and then the perianal area. So condoms may help, no guarantees. You know, again, we're still learning about this.
And what about people who are like, say someone's an ally and they're not necessarily someone who's at a high risk. What can they do right now to support people who are at high risk?
That's a really good question. I guess go out and learn about it. There are a lot of great firsthand sources. You can go to the World Health Organization, the UK's health agency, the European one, the CDC. Looking at all these sources combined can give you a good picture of what the demographics are. You know, I'm always sending them to people on Twitter, like, don't take my word for it. You know, my LeVar Burton quote, you know, look to these firsthand sources. There are a few great peer-reviewed papers out about it. But also, I think just asking people what they're going through. This has been a really scary time for a lot of gay men. It's been a very disappointing summer where they were hoping to have more fun and get out there in the world, you know, after these 2 years of COVID. And it's been really dispiriting. So just like asking what people are going through, how they're feeling about that. People who contract the virus, they may have, you know, feelings of shame about it. It's tied in with sex. And there's all this stigma about that. I interviewed a guy over the weekend who'd had it. And he said he was really wrestling with trying to rediscover intimacy after this experience. You know, he was really thrown for a loop. It really reminded me of what a lot of people go through after they contract HIV, and they're trying to sort of peel apart their feelings of having contracted this virus from sexual experience and trying to enjoy that again. So, you know, allyship, you know, it's so great. I think, you know, part of it is just also accepting that your group, you know, that if you're not a gay man, you're not men who sex with men, is at low risk, and saying that out loud, and that's okay. And saying like, these are the people who are more risk now. My group is not, but I am concerned about them. And that's something that really bothers me about a lot of the misinformation peddlers you see online. Is one thing that's pretty uniform throughout all of them is they never mention gay men. And that is shocking. It's very hurtful, frankly, and very offensive to me as a gay man myself, that they're not concerned about what gay men are going through. They're only concerned about what might happen in some other group. And then they come up with all these wild speculations and wild theories about that. And some of their theories could come true, but why are they so concerned about what might happen when there's so much that's already happening right now that's very concerning?
Yeah, I mean, it's a form of homophobia. That's the way that I'm seeing it, because they're not able to decenter themselves for, I'm especially talking about the main purveyors of disinformation. They're not able
to. You know who you are, everyone.
Exactly. They're not able to decenter, and they're so focused on keeping their captive audience that they're doing this incredible disservice to the gay community. And I think that's really, really concerning. And that is something that allies can do, is to say, hey, you know, I'm not at the center of this. Everyone felt like they were at the center of their own universe with COVID, but this is different than COVID. And that's a message that really needs to get out. And I think that you're doing an amazing job with getting that, that news out there.
What the good news is, this is not 1981. This is not the early AIDS crisis. We have so many people who are on our side, gay men. You know, you look to what happened in the Reagan's administration, the totally dismissive attitude towards AIDS, Ed Koch's administration in New York City, night and day what we're seeing now. First of all, there are all these gay guys who work in government, who work in public health, who are out there, but we have so many allies. And that's been really impressive and heartwarming to me. You know, from day one, Rochelle Walensky, the head of the CDC, comes out of the HIV world, you know, in Boston and at Harvard. So, you know, she's like a big mom out of the gays. You know, I totally trust that she is absolutely committed to it, even if there are many ways that you can criticize her choices. So there's a lot to be thankful for and optimistic about on that front. And if, you know, there's a lot of these sort of fears, oh, if they find out that this is only in the gays, no one will care. So I just don't see evidence of that. I see evidence there's a lot of hate out there, and it's getting worse these days, sadly, towards LGBTQ people. We know that, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene, Ron DeSantis, all of these public figures, that's very concerning. But at the same time, we have so much support, and the government really is going to bat for us in many ways, even if, yes, there are absolutely many ways that we can criticize them that are of great cause.
Now, as we're looking at the monkeypox crisis in real time, are there lessons that could be learned for next time, for managing the next crisis, regardless of what it is?
Well, this is a message to the funders of research, essentially. And what we've seen is that there's been a slow burn of this outbreak in Africa for the last 52 years that we have been aware of. And there's been a disinvestment in studying that and fighting it in Africa. So I just spoke with Tom Frieden, the former CDC director from the Obama administration, who told me, you know, a decade ago, he really wanted to do that kind of work in Africa, but there weren't the resources. So we've seen time and again where outbreaks have occurred in that part of the world, and then they've spread to the rest of the world. And guess where the tipping point is, where everybody starts caring and the money starts flowing? It's when it starts affecting the wealthier nations. So that's a real tragedy. But in terms of, you know, when it comes to disinformation, I guess I just return to, we all need to be more discerning consumers of information. I remember being in the sixth grade and they had this lesson plan where they gave us this, it's called the Nasarima lesson plan. And you learn about this strange culture where they do all these weird things in the morning. They go to this shrine and they worship it. And then afterwards, they tell you that Nasarima is American spelled backwards. And what you've just read is loaded language. It's describing the everyday behavior of an American, but with this totally inflated language, makes everybody sound totally nuts. You know, like, who would behave this way? You know, but it's a way to teach young people in school that, like, people who are giving you information may not be trustworthy, and it's up to you to figure out who is. So it would be really great if we had more training in schools for how to consume information better, so people can be more on guard. And there's a way, it's called sort of inoculation, and there are researchers who do this for like climate information, and they show you, for example, in a lesson plan in schools, this is how the sausage is made, this is how disinformation is made, and they find that after people are told that, they are more discerning consumers of information and are better able to spot when somebody's essentially trying to either trying to deliberately fool them, or, you know, a source of information that just doesn't understand it anyway and is not to be trusted.
Wow, that's great. I think in addition to media literacy, we need more social media literacy, and you're right at the front line of that. And it's amazing the work that you're doing. Ben, it's great talking with you, and thank you again for your time.
Yeah, thank you. It's been really interesting.
You're listening to Noncompliant, a neurodiversity podcast. I'm your host, Anne Borden King. Noncompliant is recorded at MCS Studios and transcribed by Julianne Lee. This episode was engineered by Lucien Lozon. Thanks to our team, and thanks for listening.